You're tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, and around the world on cooperadio.org. Coming up, here they come, it's Animal Voices time. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Animal Voices, the weekly program that focuses on animal issues and encourages compassion and respect for all living creatures. My name is Marge Adams. In the studio with me are Alan Jensen, announcer and technician, and co-host Carl Loskin. This show is presented through the cooperative efforts of three local organizations, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, Earth Save Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society. Ideas expressed on the show are not necessarily those of these organizations. At the top of the hour, Carl Loskin will be interviewing Dr. Melanie Joy of Strategic Action for Animals. Carl, could you tell us what your topic is for today?
Yes, as you mentioned, Dr. Melanie Joy is the author of a wonderful book called Strategic Action for Animals, and in which she enumerates how we can work together for a stronger movement, including activism for animal liberation.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Now, Dr. Joy will be calling in very shortly. I'm going to be talking to Annalise Sorg later in the hour, and she is the founder and president of Coalition for No Whales in Captivity, and Vice President of the Marine Environment Protection Society. So we'll be having a discussion about whales. Now, we have a few minutes, Carl, I know you have something about hidden diseases in livestock. Maybe we could just hear about that, please.
Yes, surprised to give me this one. Yes, it was an article, I think, in the Vancouver's National Post, I think, and it said that healthy livestock can carry harmful bacteria. It was on the front page of the National Post, so they considered it to be rather a leading article. So these hidden diseases come about because of the resistance that's happening with indiscriminate use of and widespread use of antibiotics with factory farmed animals, basically because I feel they're living in so many unsanitary conditions that antibiotics are regularly used, and that when these animals develop an immunity to these antibiotics, this is asymptomatic in the pigs. It doesn't show up. And people can also develop, by consuming the flesh of these animals, can also develop a immunity to the different antibiotics. But one of the issues that I felt was also asymptomatic was that mad cow disease outbreaks in Canada from time to time. It gets hidden on the back pages, but also they're basically not testing the younger cows, the calves before slaughter, only after, I think, a certain number of years, but these diseases can also be latent in the animals, because this is the sad truth, is that today we still feed animals to cows. We're not feeding cows to cows, but we're still feeding animals to cows. And that many of these animals that are being fed to cows, I think it's with milk replacer, which is fed to calves,
it doesn't give them the immunity that the mother's milk would give.
Well, absolutely. And of course, the calves are taken away from their mothers on literally on the day after they're born. Mm-hmm. But it takes a number of years for the cows to become downer cows, to show symptoms that they are in fact ill. And I think that this article, it said hidden diseases, and there are many hidden diseases because of many of the unsanitary and, to my mind, illogical practices which are endemic in animal husbandry.
Yes, there was a study done on that, and I believe it was mentioned in that same article about the pigs the way they were raised was causing them the disease. For the sake of the study, they focused on salmonella, which is a cause of many human outbreaks, which trigger symptoms ranging from vomiting to fever and bloody diarrhea. They found that 6% of the pigs carried the bacteria, although the range was from as little as 1% in Saskatchewan to more than 9% in Ontario, much higher than earlier estimates. Now, that was interesting to me. I just wondered if Saskatchewan has maybe greater freedom for their pigs, or they have more land that is not so expensive as in Ontario. There must be a reason why it's so much less in Saskatchewan than Ontario. But symptom-free hogs carried several different strains of salmonella, including a number that were resistant to one or more antibiotics. So it's a sort of sad state of affairs, and recommendations were made to change the way the animals are cared for.
Yes, and there was another article in the Vancouver Sun which said, beware if you're driving behind a truck which is loaded full of maybe 10,000 chickens because of the bacteria that can be emitted from that. You saw that, Alan?
No, but it's an interesting... I have never thought of that, but it makes sense that, I will keep back, but I wouldn't want to be anywhere near them. Yes.
Well, Dr. Melanie Joy is the author of Strategic Action for Animals, and is a wonderful handbook on strategic movement building, organizing, and activism for animal liberation. Dr. Joy is a professor of sociology and psychology at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Her academic areas of specialization include psychosociology of violence towards animals and humans and organizational behavior. Welcome to Animal Voices, Dr. Melanie Joy.
Hi, Carl. Thank you for having me.
Well, your book is a magical catalog, but how can we be working for a stronger movement in animal rights?
Well, thank you. My book is fairly comprehensive in that it covers all three levels of strategy from, movement building, organizing, and individual activism or advocacy. So I wrote it for busy activists who don't have time to read through a bunch of different books that cover one or another aspect of strategy, and I wanted them to have everything they need in a single handbook that's tailored specifically for people working toward creating a better world for non-human animals. But because we've got limited time to discuss some of what I talk about in the book, I was thinking I'd like to focus on one aspect of strategy that I think everyone can benefit from. Whether they're working in an organization or on their own, and regardless of what issue they're working on or how long they've been working for animals. And I'd like to discuss strategic advocacy for animals. So, in other words, how to communicate your message in a way that's empowering to yourself and others, and that increases the likelihood that your message will be received in the way that you intend it to be.
So what is the strategic advocacy of?
Well, strategic advocacy for animals is it's essentially strategic communication, and that includes nonverbal communication as well. For those of us who are working to make the world a better place for animals, we're essentially ambassadors for the movement, for better or worse. So how we present ourselves to others, both people who aren't involved in the movement as well as other animal activists, can have a profound effect on how these people feel about and respond to our message. I wanted to look at, because I don't really have time to get into all the principles and tools of strategic advocacy, what I'd like to discuss is what I think is the foundation of effective communication.
Sure. And you have a wonderful example there of how people reacted differently to different people, like activists, conveying a different message.
Yes, and people, exactly, and the way that we can convey our message will have a profound impact on whether the message is received or not and how the message is received. So, one way to think about this, I would say, what I think the foundation of effective communication is to model the change that we're trying to bring about in others. As Gandhi said, to become the change that you wish to see in the world. So when we discuss animal issues, we're asking others to be open-minded, compassionate, empathic, and receptive. And so we've got to be willing to do the same. And if not, we can come across, dogmatic. We can come across as untrustworthy, as if we don't have the listener's best interest at heart.
Right. And you have a wonderful example in your book about one person who was at a vegan at a meal, and then, it didn't come over properly. And then another example of where the message came through and the person carried through. So maybe you can just give that example there.
Yes, okay. I had witnessed somebody once at a dinner party, a vegan, I overheard a conversation, and somebody had asked a vegan, why she had become vegan. And she started kind of rattling off all the reasons, suffering of farmed animals, and all of the things that she does and has done without in order to become vegan and support the movement. And went on and on talking about this, and the listener walked away, and I later overheard him saying something about those crazy vegans, and he had genuinely been interested in her motivations, and could have been very receptive to what she had to say. The other example I used was one of my students in a class who also is vegan, and talked to another student who had worked for human rights for a number of years but had never made the connection between animal rights and human rights. And she presented the issue in a way that was empathic, that was compassionate. She shared her own story, and she recognized that for him, it would be very hard for him, as a person who cares deeply about suffering, to come to terms with his own participation in the suffering of animals. And she was very sensitive in the way that she shared the issue and talked about her own experience, her own guilt when she had realized what she had participated in. And eventually he did actually become a proponent of animal rights, and I believe it was because his first exposure was to somebody who modeled the change that she wanted to see.
That's great. So now maybe you will admit that the odds are so much of a David and Goliath issue here, when a few people who understand the animal issue, and also the enormous monolithic size of the industry backed mm-hmm. by government, and that even the best people can become a bit frustrated at times and say things that maybe they shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a sort of overpowering thing at times. And, maybe you can criticize me here. I walked past the meat counter at a big store, and everybody, they pick up the meat, and they look at it. And I walked by, and I said, flesh from tortured animals. And later on that day, I met one of my neighbors, and she said, you were saying something as you walked by the meat counter. So maybe you can assess my wrongful act there.
Well, I can understand why you would say what you said and why you would think what you said. I mean, it's it's important to appreciate that it's extremely difficult. We're discussing the issues that we're discussing are so morally loaded. And when you're acutely aware of the extent and the gratuitousness of animal suffering, it's very hard to not express yourself in a way that you feel compelled to express yourself in the moment. It's very hard to kind of keep your cool, and I've experienced this a lot myself. Just for instance, like sitting across from somebody who we know eats dead animals, and we might think for no reason other than the fact that they taste good, naturally invites some level of judgment. But one way to think about this, and one way to communicate with people, I think, that's really important to remember is to be process rather than content focused. So the content of a conversation is the what. It's what's being discussed. Like, so for example, the content could be veganism, animal experimentation, or, you know, whether to stay in or go out on a Saturday night. But the process is the how. It's how the content's communicated. It's the dynamics of the conversation. So if the process is healthy and empowering, the conversation will be productive. It's challenging to have an empowering process around issues that are so morally loaded and that can trigger such powerful emotions in us. But one way, I think, you know, one of the most important ways to do this is to, an empowering communicative process includes, first and foremost, being a compassionate witness, in the words of author Kathy Weingarten. And compassionate witnessing is the act of bearing witness to others, you know, whether those others are a group that you're talking to, one other person that you're interacting with, but bearing witness with empathy, compassion, and without judgment. It's really listening and truly trying to put yourself in the shoes of another. You know, a compassionate witness listens and speaks without judgment, and the minute judgment comes in, we're no longer compassionately witnessing, and we can end up creating defensiveness rather than receptivity.
Now, you're doing it, Dr. Melanie Joy, in a wonderful way, because you're presenting a book on how to a strategic action. But in your book, there was a wonderful quote there, and it said, the only sure weapon against bad ideas is better ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a struggle to become informed, mm-hmm. to read your book, for one, and to be able to convey that message in a kind way.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. To be able to convey our message in a way so that people feel safe and empowered when they're listening to us talk. And one of the issues that I've been witnessing over and over again, and it's very understandable, you know, in the movement, is this, you know, our kind of natural tendency to make judgment, to pass judgment on people that haven't made the same choices, you know, that we have, for instance, as vegans. You know, the problem with this is that the dangers of judgment, when somebody feels judged, they feel shamed. Judgment is shaming, and shame is the feeling of being less than or of being one down or inferior, feeling like you have less power or worth than you actually do. And shamed people feel powerlessness, and people go to great lengths to avoid this feeling. And one way they do this is by becoming the opposite of shamed, which is grandiose. Grandiosity is, it's the armor that hides a person's feeling of shame. It's feeling more than or superior. You know, so for instance, a vegetarian advocate might shame a meat eater, or a carnist is the term that I use, who then turns around and calls the vegetarian a hypocrite for wearing wool. So the challenge is to walk that fine line between sharing beliefs in a way that's empowering without inviting, you know, and not invite the defensiveness. You know, and one of the things that you just mentioned is, you know, if we present the facts to people, you know, how do we present the facts in a way that's empowering? A catch here is that, you know, a lot of the time, understandably, we tend to assume that once meat eaters, for instance, understand the facts about factory farming, they'll no longer want to eat animals. But for most people, the facts don't sell the ideology.
Nice.
People are often wedded to a deeply embedded worldview, you know, what's called their frame or their schema. And when the facts don't fit the frame, people tend to discard the facts and keep the frame.
Now, Dr. Melanie Joy, you've observed the animal movement, liberation movement. Mm-hmm. And how would you say this is developing, in the short term or maybe 5-year period?
Mm-hmm. Well, the million-dollar question. People have all different ideas about the evolution of the movement and whether we're, you know, actually doing the work that we need to be doing. And there's a lot of confrontation among different groups in the movement, arguing that we should be doing one thing or another to improve our efforts. But personally, I believe, you know, even though animal suffering is at an all-time high, I believe that the efforts of activists have quite likely staved off what would have even been more suffering, more animal suffering. And I mean, the reason I wrote this book is because I really do believe in the power and the evolution of the movement. I believe in the power and the commitment and dedication of activists. And, you know, when you mentioned in the beginning of this interview that, you know, what do we, David and Goliath, there's sort of a David and Goliath issue here. We're up against, you know, these industries with billions and billions of dollars on their side and very entrenched ideology that they're maintaining. How do we even begin to, you know, challenge that? But strategy is, it's the great equalizer. So strategy, for instance, if, you know, if everybody can become twice as effective at what they're doing, then the movement's effectiveness would double. So I have very high hopes for the movement. I see us evolving. I see a lot of progress, more movements than ever, you know, popping up. And, you know, we're really coming at animal exploitation from diverse angles.
Now, that's wonderfully encouraging, Melanie, and Animal Voice has been on the air for 9 years, and it's we get through to some people. But I have a problem with the word activism, and maybe you can just break it down, because it has different components, which includes, you know, activism in the form of some kinds of violence, and even harsh words can be violent. So maybe you can tell me something. Yeah, I know you're a psychosociologist, maybe, about why I would have a, I don't call myself an activist. I just see that we're just doing it as we're going along, you know. This is, you know, we're making a change little by little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great point that you bring up. You know, activist in some ways has become like a four-letter word. One way to understand it is it's kind of a backlash. You know, a backlash is a, you know, often a backlash is a reaction of the dominant group, or, you know, the group in power against a social movement that's made enough strides to actually challenge their power. And one way they do this is by shooting the messenger. You know, so feminist, for instance, has become a dirty word. And this happened when the feminist movement, you know, became powerful enough to really challenge the male power structure in society. So people stopped using the word, and I think the same thing has happened to activists, too. And, you know, activist, really, if you break it down, it just simply means anybody who's actively working towards change. And people, like many words, interpret this in all different ways. Some activists do... not many, but some do support violent tactics. I personally do not, and I wrote about that in my book. And other activists do not support them. So I think, you know, we tend to associate activist with militant, and that may be what you're referring to.
Sure. Now, true change, as you said earlier, must come with oneself. So one has to, one has to walk the talk. Mm-hmm. Not to be considered to be a hypocrite, I applaud every person who does something for the betterment of animals, even though they might wear a fur coat. Is that justified?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, one of the problems in the movement is when people become when people have an idea about what it means to work for animals, and if we don't follow that one idea, then we're not really doing the work. But the truth is, if that person wearing a fur coat has saved 6 kittens from, you know, the freezing back alley, then those are 6 kittens that would not have otherwise been saved. And I do applaud, and I think it's very important to support any effort toward change, because we need all the help that we can get. And, you know, there are plenty of people who can become turned off if they're told. People don't feel comfortable participating in exactly the same way. You know, so some people might be comfortable participating in direct action. You know, others may not, and we need to have an openness, again, just as we want to encourage others to be open and receptive, we've got to have an openness and receptivity as well as a movement.
Over to you, Marge. Marge has a question.
Yes, I'm most interested in what you're saying. I like the term compassionate witness. I think that's probably what I think of as a good listener. And I'm thinking that's probably a way to avoid argument, because once you get into an argument with a person, they pretty well steal over, don't they? And they're not going to accept your point of view and defend their own. Is that what a compassionate witness would do?
Yes, exactly. It was a phrase that was coined by author Kathy Weingarten, and I write about this to some extent in my book. Yeah, if we're compassionate witnesses, it means that we're able to see the world through the eyes of the other. And mm-hmm. then we respect their inherent worth as a being, a human being, as a living being. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it can help us understand that the vast majority of people make the choices that they do not because they don't care, and, you know, and sometimes not because they don't know better, but because those are choices that make them feel safe with where they're at. And mm-hmm. It does, you know, if you're, it's the foundation of nonviolent conflict resolution. Compassionate mm-hmm. witnessing also exists on a collective level as well. You know, if you think about it, virtually every atrocity that's been committed in the history of humankind has been enabled by a populace that turned away from a reality that they felt was too painful to face. And virtually every social transformation or revolution was made possible because a group of people chose to bear witness, and they demanded that others bear witness as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Melanie Joy, we just have about a minute left here. I was wondering if you could summarize some of the important things that we've just said here, and just you've said it in such a wonderful way.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, it's, you know, getting back to what I had started talking about, which is becoming the change you wish to see, change starts with oneself. You know, so to avoid judgment, you know, we have to become conscious. We've got to be committed to our own self-awareness and our own personal growth. The way that we treat others as a movement and as individuals is a reflection of the way that we feel about ourselves. So if, for instance, we feel guilty, maybe because we feel like we're not doing enough for the animals, then we can project this guilt onto others. You know, so in other words, we see in others a reflection of our own guilt, and we can take it out on them by judging them. So if we can make a commitment to compassionately witnessing ourselves, our internal dialogue, and compassionately witnessing others and our impact on others, you know, if we can really ask ourselves, when people see themselves through their eyes, what do they see? And we can do our best to create a vision of themselves that we want them to aspire to.
Right. And now, if your wonderful book is called Strategic Action for Animals, Dr. Melanie Joy, PhD, and how can people get your book?
Oh, thank you. Well, it's available through my publisher's website. It's Lantern Books, www.lanternbooks.com, and it's also available on Amazon and all the major online booksellers.
Thank you, Dr. Melanie Joy, for being on Animal Voices. You've been wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Bye for now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Our webpage is animalvoices.org. Many of our programs are posted right there on animalvoices.org. Over to you, Maj.
Yes, thank you for that. Very interesting interview. I think the points need to be made over and over again, don't they? Because I know we can come out being very dogmatic and make other people uncomfortable, and that's the very last thing you want to do if you're trying to get your point of view over and be convincing. So that, yeah, she has a really good message. Now perhaps we could have just a little break before our second guest is going to be calling in.
Yeah, okay, there's a little bit of music coming up. Chris Newman and a nice piece, the Mallard's Minuet. And you can just imagine those mallards getting up and doing the minuet.
yourself.
Oh, thank you, Alan. That was very pleasant. I have an item here, just while we're waiting to get our next view, interviewer on the line. This is an article that was written by a columnist for the Vancouver Sun, David Baines, and he's writing about people should choose where to get pet drugs. I thought it was interesting and well worth repeating here, but in part. I'm not going to read the whole article because it is long. Now, he starts by saying, in two previous columns, I noted that my 16-year-old standard poodle had developed arthritis, and our veterinarian had prescribed an anti-inflammatory called Duramax, which is specially formulated for dogs. Realizing this was a chronic condition, I asked the vet for a copy of the prescription so we could look at generic alternatives or other sources of supply, such as online pharmacies. She refused to provide it. Now, when I was advised her that according to the BC Veterinary Medical Association, she is obliged to give it to us, she summarily dismissed us as clients. Her apparent objection was that we were intending to take the prescription to an online pharmacy, which she distrusts. I say it's our business where clients take their prescriptions. The BC Veterinary Medical Association agrees. Also, the BC College of Pharmacists say we can put as much trust in online pharmacies as conventional pharmacies, as long as they are licensed. And finally, there are substantial savings to be had. In my case, I could get Duramax from a licensed online pharmacy for 20% less. Now, when he did some investigation, David Baines found that the CBC Marketplace had canvassed this very subject last November. And the host, Erica Johnson, took her cat to 5 vet clinics in Vancouver and was quoted $6 to $22 for a bottle of insulin. According to a drug distribution catalog, that same drug costs the vet $4.16. So the markup ranged from 44% to 429%. And now the BCVMA bylaws say that the veterinarians must be forthright, objective, and impartial in serving their clients. They must refrain from imposing fees that are excessive in relation to the nature and quality of the services provided, and they must provide enough information and advice to enable the client to make informed choices.
If we dial your number here, we're not getting through.
No.
I'm calling you from my cell phone.
The bottom line of all this is that the
BC
vets have by and large kept the pet drug business in-house affair to say it's time to reform and restructure the distribution system, remove constraints and competition, and give consumers the information and opportunity they choose. So I thought that was a pretty powerful item that he had written, and he at the same time, though, considers the vets to be a very noble people in many ways for dealing with animals and often being generous to people who can't afford the full price of their vet care, etc. But it's something worth thinking about. If you have a pet, especially one who has a chronic ailment, it might be worthwhile going to the internet and seeing what is available there from licensed suppliers. I'll tell you where the article, if you want to read the entire article, go to the Vancouver Sun, Saturday, November the 8th of this year. And that's page 13. Vancouver Sun, September the 8th, on page 13. Thank you. Oh, I hear that our interviewee now is on the line. Hello, Annalise, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Kim. Hi, Marge.
Oh, hi. Let me just tell people that I'm now speaking with the founder and president of the Coalition for No Whales in Captivity, and she is also the vice president of the Canadian Marine Environment Society. Annalisa, it's wonderful to have you on the show. It's been a long time.
Thanks, Marge. It's great to be back.
Now, I want to get right to the subject, and that's, of course, whales. And when we use the word dolphins and whales, they're pretty well synonymous, aren't they, or can be used that way?
It's they're all cetaceans, and mm-hmm. cetaceans include whale species, dolphin species, and porpoises.
Okay.
And so, basically, mm-hmm. there's the great whales, the humpbacks, mm-hmm. sperm whales, gray whales, so on. Then there's the dolphins, which is orcas, belugas, and narwhals.
Okay.
They're smaller species. And then there's the porpoises, who actually are the size of dolphins, but they have flat teeth instead of conical teeth. So, but they're all whales. We can talk about the wonderful whale, the
all
wonderful
right.
world of whales in
Good.
General.
Good. Now, the one issue that maybe we could start with is the whales that are trapped in the Arctic Ocean, and
yes.
and in danger, serious danger, aren't they? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, in serious danger, not only now, but they are highly at risk species, and we're talking about narwhal whales. Most people probably know them as the ice unicorns, the unicorns of the sea, because the male narwhals manage to grow a long tooth that spirals out like a unicorn would. This is very unfortunate because that tooth is ivory.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what happens with the elephants and poachers.
Indeed,
ivory.
I do, yeah.
We have the same problem with the narwhals. They are selected when the Inuit go hunting. They will try to shoot the narwhals with the longest tusks. And there are some narwhals that grow two teeth, two tusks.
Oh.
And they are sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars over the Internet. So, unfortunately, this little whale is being hunted to extinction to basically sell the ivory tusks.
Is he only found up in the Arctic?
Yes, it's mm-hmm. only in the Arctic Circle. There are a few whales that are only found in the Arctic Circle, like belugas and bowhead whales as well. The narwhals that we're talking about, and the reason that there's so much concern right now, is because, of course, the climate change is making the Arctic freeze faster. And what's happened is there have been a few hundred narwhals that have been trapped in amidst the ice, and they have few breathing holes. And mm. there's a concern that they will not be able to make the open ocean.
Oh,
now,
my.
The problem is that when these animals were spotted, the DFO decided to go ahead and give the permit to go and shoot them dead instead of trying to help them. This is just unconscionable, really. They thought there was 200 narwhals trapped there. Without authorities even reaching the site, they started shooting them. And it's a gruesome sight, Marge, because these poor animals are trying, they're mammals, so they have to breathe. So they come, and there's bullets flying everywhere,
oh.
and they're wounding and killing, and it's a big bloodbath is what it is. It's a slaughter.
They probably should be on an endangered species list, shouldn't they, and be protected?
They should, and they are not. And this is the thing, that this could have been avoided if the DFO, if the Federal Fisheries, would have sent some icebreakers and open up a way for the narwhals. They're now thinking there's 500 narwhals trapped. Mm-hmm. And instead of sending the Coast Guard icebreaker to free these narwhals, they've allowed the hunters to go and slaughter them. And this really is unconscionable when you think about
the awful seal hunt that, of course, is subsidized by Canadian taxpayers, and how many times has the Canadian Coast Guard gone to open the ice so that the hunters could get to the seals?
So they will spend
the money for that. But they won't spend the money for these endangered narwhals.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
It's horrendous. It's horrendous. But you know, if your listeners, if you are interested, this is the time to act. So I'm hoping that your listeners will have pen and paper at hand. And really, the thing to do right now is to write to the DFO minister, to the Federal Fisheries Minister, who's the Honorable Gail Shea, S-H-E-A, and just write at the House of Commons in Ottawa, Ontario, K1A-OA6, or send her a quick email. It's shea.g@parl, as in Parliament, parl.gc.ca. And that would truly help, because there's a lot of people working on this and trying to save the remaining narwhal that are trapped there, but time is running out.
Will you give us that email address again, please?
Yes. It's her name, actually. It's Shea, S-H-E-A
dot P-A-R-L dot G-C, the government of Canada, dot C-A. Oh, that's a great idea. By all means, we should all do that. It does seem to have an impact, doesn't it, when enough people express themselves to government?
It's the only way there is an impact, and that is why programs such as yours is just so important in the animal rights movement and animal welfare movement to be able to go out to the public and say, this is what we need help with right now, because if we don't have a lot of people behind us, if the government doesn't see that Canadian voters are upset about how they are handling this situation with the narwhals and other issues, of course, then societies such as ours really have little power.
Right. Now, we also, of course, want to refer to our local whales, the orcas, often referred to as killer whales, which I always think is a very negative way to refer to the orcas. What's your response to that expression, killer whales? Can you tell us about it?
Actually, killer whales comes from the fact that there are there's two types of orcas. There's the resident orcas who eat salmon and other fish, and then there's the transient orcas, and the transient orcas eat marine mammals, and including whales.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the name killer whales, because they do kill whales. However, the name has been exploited by the aquarium industry, of course, to make the show, you know, come and see the killer whale show, woo! It's part of the marketing. So, no, the correct term is orcas, because their Latin name is Orcinus orcas. So let's refer to them as that.
As orcas. Okay. Now, their numbers are diminishing, aren't they?
And they have been for a long time. Unfortunately, during the 60s and the 70s, the aquarium industry went out and captured as many as they could take, really, and they were young. And so they took generation after generation of orcas. And this is from a population, a couple of resident populations, the southern and the northern resident population off our coast. However, then came the ban, and even though they stopped taking orcas in the late 70s, they never really recuperated. But I mean, that's not something that should surprise us, because of course, orcas and other marine mammals are having to fight not just whalers, but they have more threats today than they've ever had in history before. I mean, they have with the climate change, the marine pollution, there's destruction and degradation of critical habitats, there's entanglements in fishing gear, there's collisions with high-speed vessels, there's ocean noise pollution from shipping, there's seismic testing indiscriminate use of deadly sonar. I could keep going.
Oh, my goodness. Do they have a chance?
What's going on in the oceans? Yeah. And to top it all, they're starving is what really people are starting to realize that...
They're fish eaters, yes.
They're fish eaters, and with the overfishing that is being allowed still, this is a real problem. So getting back to the resident orcas of our coast, the southern resident orcas, according to the Center for Whale Research in Friday Harbor, they say that since last year, and they're missing 7 members of the K-pod. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but when there's only about 80 left, it is a lot. And
80 left? Is that all?
Some of the members left are, some of the members missing, some of the orcas missing are young and might have not survived the winter. But there are a lot that have been missing since this summer, not just since last year, but since last summer. Not last summer, but this summer, 2008.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
For instance, there's the mother of Luna. And Luna, your listeners might remember, there's been 2 little orcas that were lost and found by humans, basically. Mm-hmm. But they ran away from their group, if you will, just playing, I'm sure. And one of them was Springer, who was found off Seattle. And then there was a whole campaign to take Springer back home, which was to the northern resident pods, which is up in Johnson Strait. And the aquarium industry fought us to the end, really, but finally that little one was reunited with her family, her family up in the north. Well, there was another one discovered the next year. That was in 2001, and that was Luna. And Luna was a male orca, young one, that was found in Gold River, close to Port Alberni. Anyways, there's a story on that, and I'll tell you about him later. But getting back to the orcas that are missing, the mother of Luna is missing and hasn't been seen since September, and as well a brother of Luna is missing since then as well. Mm-hmm. So there's 7 orcas that are missing. One of them, and probably this one it makes sense. I mean, it's K7, who's Lumi. Now, Lumi has been missing since the spring of 2008, but she was 98 years old.
Oh, my. 98. Well, that suggests they do have a long lifeline, doesn't it?
It's parallel to humans.
It is.
They go into adolescency, at around 12, 13. Mm. They're adults around 20-something. They're... Sure. And they die at those old ages, just like healthy humans do.
Yeah, that Luna was a real little pal, wasn't he, on the coast, and people really enjoyed him. It was so tragic that he was killed.
Absolutely. It was it's such an incredible story. Mm-hmm. That they've made a documentary called Saving Luna. Now, we think it should have been called Not Saving Luna.
Sure.
Because, unfortunately, during the 3 years that this little whale was, people were trying to, quote, save him, everybody was involved. I mean, the federal government, the natives, the commercial fishermen, the aquaculture industry, the aquarium industry, the researchers, the politicians, the film, everybody. And, of course, the whole town of Gold River didn't want Luna to be returned to her pod, or let's say a whole bunch of people in the community who had vested commercial interest in keeping him there because there was so much tourism.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
So a couple of news documentary makers in Vancouver Island called Michael Parfit and Suzanne Chrisholm, mm-hmm. they followed Luna throughout these 3 years and filmed what was happening, and they put together this documentary, which will actually be released in a theater near you on December 5th.
Oh, yes.
So that's coming up. Now, this documentary has been doing the rounds and winning a lot of awards. Uh-huh. They won an award in Abu Dhabi in the Middle East International Film Festival, and it was the favorite film out of 152 movies.
Must be good.
I think so. And then it won two Panda Awards, one for Best Script, uh-huh. and the other one for Best People and Animals Documentary.
Good.
Now, I would recommend mm-hmm. to your listeners that they go see it, but always keep in mind that it's the commercial interests that always you and I busy, Marge.
Yes.
If industry, if the aquarium industry, if the whaling industry, if the politicians and so on weren't making money off, abusing animals, we would not have to be doing this kind of work.
You're right. But now you've got one other documentary you were going to mention, Dolphin Dealers.
Yes, this is very close to my heart because... this is a fellow called Christopher Porter, who was born in Williams Lake, mm-hmm. and he went to work for the Vancouver Aquarium in the early 90s. And he was trained to capture marine mammals, because the aquarium still captures sea lions and seals and so on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also trained to train dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
So he stayed at the aquarium till about 97, and then he realized what a money-making enterprise it is to trade in live dolphins. And he set up shop in the Solomon Islands, where he proceeded to capture about 170 dolphins, wild dolphins, that he put in pens and started offering them around the world to aquariums around the world.
Sounds terrible.
Oh, it's just absolutely horrendous because this is a capture from a population of dolphins that have never been studied, and there is no, not even, any concern by this fella about what this kind of capture would have done to those populations. I mean, taking so many. But it's never been done before, and certainly we would have thought that what happened was he came back to Canada for a visit, and he left a fridge full of fish for the islanders to feed the dolphins, and the islanders ate the fish, and the dolphins, most of them starved.
Oh.
So he's continued to capture dolphins and continued to sell them. He sold some to about 30 to Mexico, and now he's sold another 24, I believe, to Dubai, where with the heat and the salt water, they're dying in these tanks.
Terrible. So, I'm sorry, we're running out of time, Annalisa.
Yes,
Annalisa,
I know. So
can you tell us
I'd like to talk about this documentary's website.
Okay, good.
If your listeners want to look at it, it's called The Dolphin Dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And find it in the cbc.ca/documentaries/doczone, as in documentary zone, doczone/2008/dolphin dealer. If you just go into the cbc.ca documentaries area, you can do a search and look for Dolphin Dealer, and you can view the whole documentary online, and it is really something to see. It will give you the mentality, the kind of thing that we face.
Yeah, okay. Thank you so much for this, Annalisa. I'm sorry the time just went by so quickly. Wonderful to have you back on the show, and we'll be talking again before too long, I'm sure.
I hope so. Thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Annalisa Sorg, founder and president of Coalition for No Whales in Captivity, and the vice president of the Marine Environment Society. Now
we're
just
Alan.
About.
He's going to talk about
gorillas. Oh, Alan.
Oh, well, we don't have a lot of time left. This is just another story, in some ways similar to the stories we've been hearing about the whales, both the beluga whales and the dolphins you're talking about, and the way the populations have been diminishing. The narwhals, I suppose, particularly, are the one that's really in danger in the Canadian Arctic. Well, one other species that's in danger are the African gorillas. And this is actually a somewhat good news story. It's nice to wind up with somewhat a good news story. And the story is the government of Cameroon has created a new national park aimed at protecting the critically endangered Cross River gorilla, the world's rarest gorilla. Takamanda National Park on the border with Nigeria is the home to an estimated 115 Cross River gorillas. The total population of the subspecies is thought to be less than 300. This news comes as governments of 10 gorilla range countries gather in Rome for the first meeting of a new partnership aimed at protecting the gorillas. And what they've come up with is a program called the Gorilla Agreement. And it was finalized in June, and it brings together all the countries where the various species and subspecies of gorillas are found. And this is really positive news that all these African countries have got together in one place in Rome and come up with an agreement to try and deal. Because in all these countries, Congo, Uganda, Cameroon, the gorillas, the various populations are endangered. And it's the same sorts of problems you talk about with other animals, that the various subspecies, that the ranges of these animals are being gobbled up by farmland and forestry and so on, and so the populations are being divided, right? You've got a group here and a group there, and they used to be able to contact one another, but now they can't because they're being divided by development. So the positive news is, first of all, that Cameroon's has set up this park for the rarest of the gorilla groups, and secondly, that all these countries have come together to form the Gorilla Agreement. And also, just to sort of wrap it up, there's more information here, but I don't have time to get into the details, but The upshot is that various organizations, including the UN Environmental Program, the World Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and others, have declared 2009 the Year of the Gorilla. And so next year is the Year of the Gorilla, and I think we should endeavor on the Animal Voices show over the next year to sort of bring more updates on the gorillas and gorilla populations and what other countries in Africa are doing to try and help these amazing animals in some countries there are parks and they're being properly protected, but in others there aren't. Unfortunately, people still hunt them for meat in some areas, you know. So anyway, we have to get out of here, so you have to sign on.
Okay. Well, thank you, listeners, for being with us today. And next week, I'm going to lose my two studio mates.
We're heading off.
They're heading off for vacations, Carl and Alan. So I won't be alone, though. John Pranger, who has been a co-host for a number of years on Animal Voices, but he's not been with us for a little while. But he's a good technician as well as a co-host. So I'm looking forward to having Alan in the studio next week. Until then, have a good week, and thank you for listening.
Speaking of whales, we're going out with the sound of whales here.
Out of the water. In-